from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, the founder of Protest and Speaking of Research, groups that support the use of animals in scientific research. He's in town. We'll talk with him. Also, the local all-girl band Aphrodite's Trainwreck plays live in our studio. But first, the foreclosure crisis. There's been a lot of activity at the federal level. What is and what should California be doing? A new state law requires lenders to contact borrowers at risk of default. Is that enough? And if not, what more should the state be doing? We'll start with the legislator who co-wrote and co-sponsored that new law. He's Mike Machado, California State Senator, a Democrat representing a Western Central Valley District, District 5. Senator Machado, welcome back to Inside.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jeffrey.
What do borrowers at risk of default, what do they get out of this new law?
One of the things that concerned us that led to this law was that borrowers were not being informed of the potential for foreclosure or default. And what we're requiring under this law is that lenders must contact borrowers prior to the notice of default to try to set up a meeting to try to see if they can work out an arrangement to avoid foreclosure. This is a big initial step prior to default and leading into the foreclosure process.
But don't people know a long time in advance that they're in trouble because they're having problems meeting their mortgage payments?
That's true. But one of the problems that we face is our own pride. And oftentimes when you know you're in a situation, you don't necessarily want to recognize it. You hope that you're going to try to work it out, or you're going to try to work it out yourself. And by the time you realize that you can't, you've gone too far. By requiring the lender to make a contact prior to the notice of default, hopefully we can engage in a conversation early enough so that we can work with the lender to try to make the arrangements, or at least work through a servicer to try to avoid foreclosure.
Given the scale of the problem and the depth of the problems that a lot of individuals are in, why does the law not require the lenders to engage more actively with the borrowers who are in trouble? Rather than just requiring them to contact them, why not require something more active?
It's not only contact, but they have to set a meeting up to discuss the situation and to review the alternatives that may be available to be able to avoid foreclosure. It's a very proactive meeting. It is not just a notice.
Okay. Senator Mike Machado represents District 5. He chairs the Senate Banking, Finance, and Insurance Committee, and he was heavily involved in a new law that was called SB 1137 when it was in the legislature. It was signed into law just last month. Also in our studio is John Crenshaw. He's a Sacramento homeowner in foreclosure. John Crenshaw, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Tell us what happened.
Well, my lender notified me that I was in default. Within 90 days, they had set up a sale for my home. During this process, they told me they were going to send me paperwork to work out with me to try to modify my loan or try to see if I could stay in my home. I actually received the financial documents to start that process the day before the sale.
How long had you owned your home?
18 years.
So you're not someone that just bought his home in the last couple of years.
No, I refinanced my home about 3 years ago after my wife had surgery. And subsequently, I had a stroke. We were both in bad medical health and financial health. The surgery and my stroke, our medical health plan didn't pay for our bills. So we refinanced our home to try to get out of that debt.
Did you refinance your home under terms that, with hindsight, were not smart?
Exactly. My lender took advantage of the fact that I was sick, recovering from a stroke. He took advantage of the fact that I had a lot of equity in my home. He took advantage of my age.
Yes. Senator Machado, based on what you've heard there about John Crenshaw's experience, would this law have changed anything for him if it had been law earlier?
Well, prior to the notice of default, which has to happen before you can initiate a foreclosure and go to sale, there would have been a contact. There would have been this meeting to talk about the potential options that were available. John, I think, is one of those victims. He was trying to do the right thing for his family, but he got into a loan. I think the loan was around the euphoria of the marketplace where everybody thought things were going to continue to rise and he could eventually refinance out of that. The problem was is that the incentives for doing this on the broker was to take the fees out, make the loan, sell the loan, and the terms on this loan overcome what his ability was. And we've had laws in place now that was passed a year ago that says you can't issue a loan unless the borrower shows the ability to repay. And I would venture that this was not the case in this loan.
John, I know you can't go back in time, but if you could, what would you do differently? Or what questions would you ask that you didn't ask then?
First of all, I would never have taken out a loan. I would never again take out a loan knowing that it's going to reset or going to be increased in the payments beyond the amount that I know I make, beyond the amount that I can afford to pay. But I was lied to by my broker. I was told that I could refinance before the loan would reset, that they would help me get into this. My credit would be good because I could use the money from the loan to pay off all my bills and get a good credit rating. When it came time to do this, my broker was nowhere to be found, and I couldn't find anybody to help me to refinance. But I did at one time have an opportunity to refinance. I was told that my home value had depreciated to the level where I could no longer find anybody that would refinance me. So I was caught in a trap and a quandary and faced with losing my home and being put on the street. Me and my wife at over 60 years old, they're getting ready to put us out on the street to make us homeless.
Mm. John Crenshaw, Sacramento homeowner who's in foreclosure. Let's add another guest to the discussion. Beth Mills is communications director with the California Bankers Association, which is a self-explanatory association. Beth Mills, welcome to Insight.
Good afternoon.
What do California banks make of this new law that requires lenders to contact homeowners in trouble and set up a meeting with them to discuss their options?
Well, our association was very pleased to support Senate Bill 1137. The passage of this bill was a result of a collaborative bipartisan effort and also collaboration between industry and consumer organizations, and we feel it'll provide some real meaningful reform to help borrowers who are facing foreclosure. Our members, they're committed to working with homeowners, and, you know, our goal is to help them wherever we can to help them stay in their homes and avoid foreclosure wherever possible. We encourage any borrower who's at all having any difficulty meeting the terms of their mortgage to contact their lender and see what sort of solutions might be able to be made to work out.
But Senator Machado said earlier on that pride can get in the way and people don't necessarily actually know or want to face up to the fact that they're in trouble. So I guess you accept that that's probably the situation and the law is dealing with that.
Well, in some cases, that is the situation. Many of our bank members are members of an alliance called Hope Now, and Hope Now is a broad-based coalition of credit counselors, lenders, and investors, and other industry participants whose main goal is to proactively reach out and assist homeowners who may be in trouble. And the goal with this organization is to help them avoid foreclosure, whether it's help them with different repayment plans or possibly to get into loan modifications.
Mm. We're talking about the foreclosure crisis. There's a new law in California that requires lenders to reach out to homeowners who are in trouble. Also with us on the phone is Paul Leonard, West Coast Director of the Center for Responsible Lending. Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
What do you think about this bill, this law, rather? Does it go far enough?
I think this law is a great step forward and is an example of the kind of partnership, leadership from Senator Machado and Senator Parada, who introduced it and shepherded it through various iterations and collaboration between consumers and industry and legislators to produce a substantial advance. I think that the law is a very important step. But even with this law in place, I think the challenge still remains about whether or not lenders will be delivering effective loan modifications to borrowers.
Could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, that for borrowers who are faced with an inability to pay their current loan as a result of a variety of factors, from job loss and declining economy, or health issues, or the fact that their payments are resetting to levels that are unaffordable for them as a result of the sort of questionable terms of the loans to start out with, that the loans are made affordable for the borrower for what their incomes really are, rather than avoiding the much more expensive and economically damaging outcomes of foreclosures.
So what would you like to see the state of California do?
Well, I think that with respect to current borrowers, I think that the California's leverage are there are a few places. One is to do specific reporting for data for how effectively the individual lenders or servicing companies are in achieving these modifications as opposed to foreclosures. Right now, the Department of Corporations reports that data on an aggregate basis for all of the companies. We would like to see individualized data for each company to know which are the industry leaders and which ones are the industry laggards, and to understand where the best practices are in the industry so that we can spread those around.
Anything else?
I think the other option, an opportunity, is for the legislative leadership and for the governor to continue to hold these lenders and servicers accountable publicly for their efforts at loss in avoiding foreclosures and doing long-term affordable loan modifications.
What do you mean by holding them accountable?
Well, the governor introduced an agreement with 10 servicers last fall, in which they agreed to do long-term affordable modifications, and yet the governor has not done any public reporting on each of the lenders' performance with that agreement to date. Moreover, I think that the governor and again, the legislative leadership may be in a position. Senator Machado has done his best to, after a series of hearings, to bring forward the lenders to talk about their performance, but still, the pace of modifications, the pace of default, the pace of foreclosures and defaults is far exceeding the number of modifications.
Okay, let's first go to Beth Mills at the California Bankers Association for a reaction to that. First of all, Beth, would California banks like to see more individualized data published about which banks are leaders and which are not leaders when it comes to working with borrowers who are in trouble?
Well, I think what's important now is to let this new legislation that was just enacted last month have an opportunity to become fully implemented. A lot of our members are currently in the process of making the appropriate adjustments to policies and procedures to comply with the new regulations. I think we need to allow a significant amount of time for this legislation to become fully implemented. And
so would that be a no then?
Results.
Would that be a no?
Well, I think we need to give the current legislation a chance to work.
Okay. Paul Leonard also said that the state should be doing more to hold lenders and services accountable.
Well, I would like to make a point that it is important to note that some of the foreclosures that we're seeing today, they're a result of some risky loans that were originated by lenders who operate outside of the regulations that govern the banking industry. Banks are one of the most heavily regulated industry in the country, and some of these lenders aren't required to make the same commitment to safety and soundness that banks do.
Thank you. Senator Machado, could you respond to what we've been talking about here?
I think what you have to understand is that no longer do we have the neighborhood bank or the neighborhood savings and loan making mortgages. And many of these loans are no longer in the purview of the initial lender. They've been sold, they've been securitized, and they've been sold. They're being held in the secondary investment market. Places like China, England, Norway are holding packages of these loans. And then they contract with another entity, a servicer, to make sure that the loans payments are received, and they're the ones that's supposed to try to work with a problem loan. They're constrained by contracts, and they're kind of pushing and shove. One is, does the legislature, does government come in and regulators come in and change these contracts, or do we have to allow this to work through? And the servicer, whose primary responsibility is a fiduciary responsibility to the investor and not to the lender. This is entirely different than what it was when my folks bought their home from the neighborhood bank. And yes, I think Paul has been quite an advocate of trying to get the reforms in, but that's the hurdle we face. On the other side, the Department of Corporations in California and the Department of Real Estate over the past 18 months have been very, very proactive in pursuing where fraud has been. In the case of what John has talked about, where there may have been deception by a broker, the Department of Real Estate is stepping in after those licensees. The Department of Corporation is acquiring the data, is making public the data, though it isn't an aggregate. We are getting an indication of what's happening, but the limit is of being able to respond in large part is due to contractual arrangements that often result in issues of law in terms of how far you can go.
Let's bring in one other perspective. David Ryland is a mortgage broker at Big Valley Mortgage in Roseville. David, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
From your perspective, what do you think needs to be done about the foreclosure crisis?
Well, most of my career has been spent at the front end of lending operations, originating loans. I have a general knowledge of the servicing and the foreclosure aspects of it. My mindset is such that I believe we would be best served to utilize free market systems to correct the problem. There are a variety of ways in which this could be accomplished, but I think when we look at the mindset of lenders today, they are totally focused on loss mitigation and doing everything they can to reduce the number of dollars they are bleeding on a day-to-day basis. So incentivizing lender cooperation in loan modification and write-downs, I think, is an effective system that we should be striving to implement.
You said that a free market system should be used here, but it seems to me that part of the problem is that a lot of what's been going on has been outside of regulation, which by definition is free market.
Well, I would say that some of the behaviors that we have seen have been outside of regulation, I think outside of the boundaries of ethics. And how we would correct that, I think, is now being approached from the standpoint of creating a national registry of loan originators. And I do agree with the comments from Beth that within our industry, generally the folks within the banking environment do operate with more responsibility toward the institution. I believe that most loan originators that are under the purview of the Department of Real Estate and many under the Department of Corporations also operate with that mindset. But I think reinstilling a sense of responsibility to the ultimate investor is something that the industry does need.
David, do brokers still have incentives to steer people towards loans they can't afford?
I don't think so, and I would hope that loan originators never take that perspective. I never have, although I have had conversations with folks who've been the victims of that behavior.
Senator Machado, any comment on that?
Well, I think a year ago we enacted a bill that required that brokers who initiate loans have to adhere to the federal guidelines, which means that the borrower has to have a demonstrated ability to pay the loan back over the life of the loan. So in the case of John, where he had a reset, instead of looking at that initial period, they'd have to look over the full term of the loan on his ability to pay. And in that case, that could help in the steering issue, but more importantly, it would put him in a loan that he could pay based on what his income was.
What about the so-called liar loans, where people were basically allowed to borrow money based on what they said they made? David, how big was that among lenders in the last few years?
I would say it comprised a substantial portion, a significant percentage, maybe 20-30% of the origination volume. I don't have any specific statistics to quantify that, but here again, I would hope that loan originators always utilized prudence and determined a borrower's ability to pay before utilizing that type of product.
Is it still being done?
They're virtually no longer available, other than when an automated loan approval from Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae states that the borrower's income does not need to be further documented. In the current environment, this usually entails a person with a down payment of at least 20% or more, very high credit scores, and a demonstrated ability and intent to make their payments.
Senator Machado, are you comfortable that we're safely beyond the liar loans?
I think the market has corrected itself based on the federal guidelines and just because of the total arena of credit tightening that has made it so that people only want to make good loans, and they are trying to avoid the risk of bad loans that causes a negative impact on financial balance sheets.
Okay, let's wrap this up by touching base with everyone. Just one thing that you would like to see happen, something new or something that's tightened up or strengthened or whatever, to help our state, our country move beyond the foreclosure crisis. Let's start with Beth Mills at the California Bankers Association.
I think the legislation that we have seen at the state level and again at the federal level have taken tremendous strides to help California homeowners who may be in trouble. Again, you know, and I would just encourage any homeowner out there who is having difficulties meeting their mortgage to contact their local lender and see what sort of workout plans may be able to made to avoid a homeowner going to foreclosure.
Paul Leonard at the Center for Responsible Lending.
Yes, I think that they're counter to one of your other guests, that the one area of federal law and regulation that has not been nearly adequate for protecting borrowers going forward is around mortgage brokers. There remain significant incentives in the system. While borrowers may be verified to have their ability to repay a loan, there's no guarantee that they're going to get a good loan, and there are incentives in the form of kickbacks from lenders to brokers called yield spread premiums that continue to provide a strong financial incentive for brokers to put borrowers in loans that are more expensive than the best loan for which they qualify. One other area that is of note is having to do with the translation of documents in our mortgage system. We've read lots and lots of stories about non-English speaking borrowers who have been confused and taken advantage of because of their lack of expertise in English. We would like to see some mandatory translation of the key mortgage terms, not necessarily all the mortgage terms, into the five languages that are required to be translated under California law.
Okay. David Ryland, mortgage broker at Big Valley Mortgage.
Well, I disagree with the statement that mortgage brokers are incentivized to place borrowers in more expensive loans, because we are always competing on a day-to-day basis with the entire spectrum of lending venues available to our customers. So I am absolutely confident that for myself, for our company, and for my peers in the industry as a whole, we are delivering product that is competitively priced with a bank, a credit union, or any other institution. I do believe, though, that what we need to find are ways in which we can create more incentive on the part of current loan holders to cooperate with borrowers who are in situations where they owe more than what the property is presently worth, or they're having difficulty with the payments that they are making right now.
Yes. John Crenshaw, Sacramento homeowner who's in foreclosure, what would you like to see?
Well, just like the government bails out large investment companies and banks, I see where they spend billions of dollars of my tax dollars to bail out these companies to keep them solvent, these banking firms, these investment firms like Barris and Stearns. Well, what about the poor borrower who was duped and taken advantage of? What about putting some money somewhere where they could take advantage of being made solvent, of being helped, of being allowed to stay in their home? If they're going to give all my tax dollars to these investors because they lost on a bad investment where they duped people out of their homes, why not help the people who are the poor people that work all their lives to stay in their homes?
Okay. And Senator Mike Machado, you're in a position to do things, although you are termed out at the end of this year.
Well, I think there's a number of things that have happened. We've had the federal government has come out with a new set of regulations called Regulation Z that address some of the problems that Mr. Leonard has brought about. The Congress has passed the new housing stimulus bill that would help provide some relief to homeowners like John. I think the state needs to have conformity with federal law. We also need greater enforcement of the laws by our regulatory agencies, in particular the Department of Real Estate and the Department of Corporations. And for your listeners out there who feel that they have been dealt with less than forthright, or there's been fraudulent activity on behalf of a broker, they ought to call the Department of Real Estate or the Department of Corporations and register a complaint between that individual. And there is avenues there to either, one, get rid of the bad apple, or to see whether or not there is a recourse to help them in a particular situation.
That's Senator, California State Senator Mike Machado. Also in our studio, homeowner John Crenshaw. On the phone, Beth Mills of the California Bankers Association, Paul Leonard of the Center for Responsible Lending, and David Ryland of Big Valley Mortgage. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, we'll talk with a prominent advocate of the use of animals in scientific research. He's in town. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can get a daily RSS feed telling you what's on the next edition of Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. An exhibit featuring photos taken by former child prostitutes is opening in Sacramento. Monday on Insight, you'll hear about the exhibit and learn about an agency that houses and educates Cambodian children rescued from human trafficking. Also, you'll meet the Northern California-born filmmaker behind Holler Back, Not Voting in an American Town. That film will be shown as part of the Sacramento Film and Music Festival. A prominent supporter of the use of animals in scientific research is in town. Tom Holder founded the British group Pro-Test in 2006, and earlier this year, a U.S. counterpart called Speaking of Research. Earlier today, Holder spoke at the UC Davis Primate Center. He joins us now by phone. Tom Holder, welcome to Insight.
Good afternoon.
You're not a scientist, as I understand. Your degree is in politics, philosophy, and economics. Why are you interested in the use of animals for research as an issue?
The whole issue became very big during my time at university, at which point Oxford University was under concerted attack by animal rights extremism. And the whole issue there made me look at the general issue of animal research. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized it wasn't just something that I should agree with, but something that really needs to be defended at a time where it was under threat.
When you see animal rights extremism, what do you mean by that exactly?
Animal rights extremism is when they go beyond the law to try and sell their message across to the public. So, for instance, in Oxford, they put 3 gallons of petrol in the boathouses, causing $1 million damage, and then put bombs around the campus. But more recently in Santa Cruz, we've seen a family have to escape out a top floor window because animal rights extremists have put firebombs at the front door.
When you were at Oxford, though, the actions of what you call animal rights extremists did not personally affect your studies, your own research. How did it touch you? What caused you to become actively involved in this issue?
Well, it was affecting everyone. The fact is that those students it didn't matter what subject you were doing, as you moved around the university, you would often be harassed by animal rights activists that the boathouses, which were student-run, student-owned, was an attack against students. And in fact, they followed it up saying all students were legitimate targets for their campaign.
My guest is Tom Holder, co-founder of Pro-Test, a group in Britain that supports the right of scientists to use animals in research. He now lives in the U.S. and has founded a similar group called Speaking of Research. He spoke earlier today at the UC Davis Primate Center. What do you say to people who are passionate supporters of animal rights but do not do extreme or violent things in support of their cause?
Well, I respect their beliefs, but at the same time, I think that unfortunately they put, or their views are not ones which can be reconciled with modern medicine. The fact is that without animal research, we would not have had penicillin, insulin, or more recently, Herceptin for breast cancer and Gardasil for cervical cancer.
But penicillin and insulin, those were discovered a long time ago.
Both of them are, but they're still used a huge amount. In fact, in this country, we prescribe 150 million antibiotics every single year, and most of those antibiotics will all have been a product of animal research. In fact, just about all of them.
Yes. Do you think that scientists should at least be working towards the elimination of all use of animals for research, for example, by using computer modeling and so on?
Well, the word alternatives is somewhat a misnomer because, in fact, these methods are used, but they're used alongside the animal research. Animal research continues to be a small part of research, but it is a small but vital piece. Essentially, computer models, for instance, have shortcomings. Most of the actual data created that you put into the computer will be from animal models, and much of the time we simply don't have the raw computing power. Similarly, test tubes and whatnot don't have a full organ system, so you can't see what happens as a very complex body like humans and animals, what happens when different parts interact with each other and when drugs interact with one part, get broken down, then move into another part of the body.
I know that animal rights supporters would say, well, all of that is fine and may well be true, but animals have no control over how they're treated, and therefore humans don't have the right to take over their bodies and perhaps even inflict pain on them.
Well, I think then the animal rights groups have the wrong target on the grounds that we use at max 25 million animals in this country, which about 95% are birds, rats, mice, and fish. And we use 9 billion chickens each year for food. So considering that the conditions in labs are probably the most highly regulated with animals of any industry in America, one must consider that they really have the wrong target if they're simply there to improve animal welfare.
Speaking of conditions in labs, though, you probably heard the story about the 32 research monkeys who died in an accident at a lab in Nevada, in Sparks, Nevada. There was a serious problem with the heating system, and the monkeys died. How do you respond to stories like that?
Well, that sounds like an absolutely terrible tragedy, and I hope that the inspectors will go in and ensure that such a thing could never happen again. But, I mean, it is worth noting that similar accidents happen to people around the world. There's just some things where it is not the norm. It is a freak accident that just happens to occur. I don't know more about that specific incident, I'm afraid, so I can't comment directly on it. But I would hope that inspectors would go in and ensure that such a thing could never happen again.
Are you confident that scientists in the United States and Britain and other Western countries are doing everything they can to minimize the use of animals in research and to minimize discomfort or pain that might be caused?
Yes, scientists hold very true to a rule called the three R's, which are principles of good science made by scientists for scientists. They are refinement, which is essentially making the lives of animals better in order to reduce stress and all sorts, reduction, using as few animals as possible to get the results, and replacement, wherever it is possible to replace with a non-animal method, legally scientists must use that.
Do you distinguish between different types of animals? In other words, do you think that perhaps there are certain types of testing that can be done on rats but that could not be done in chimpanzees, for example?
Well, in this country there are IACUC committees which ensure that the benefits or potential benefits to humans or indeed animals, since most veterinary medicine comes through animal research, outweighs the cost to any animals being used in the experiment. And thus, we would never use, for example, a large group of monkeys to try and make another Tylenol-type drug. But if it was for AIDS research, then we would very likely use monkeys, partly because they're more suitable models in that case. However, there is an ongoing effort to use the lowest suitable animal wherever possible. And with the increasing use of transgenic mice, we're finding that mice models are becoming more and more suitable and are taking over. In fact, monkeys, dogs, and cats together account for only 0.5% of all the research on animals in this country.
When you spoke earlier today at the UC Davis Primate Center, I assume you were speaking with scientists and students who are studying to become scientists. What are you saying to those people? Are you rallying them? Are you making specific proposals for changes in the law or what?
Essentially, I tell them about the experiences in the UK, about how when scientists come together, we find that the violence surrounding the issue goes down. I talk to them about the science just to ensure that everyone knows how to present the scientific arguments to those who are not always well-versed in science. And finally, to try and convince them to do things such as to speak at a local school to counter, say, PETA information on animal research, or to speak up just to friends. One of my main points is that people need to just talk to each other about what goes on in animal laboratories and talk about the conditions in them and how they're actually very impressive. This kind of activity, just so that the information is out there for the public to make an informed decision.
You got involved in this work in 2006 when you were studying at Oxford University in England, but you moved to the United States in March of this year. Why did you move to the US?
I'd finished my degree, and immediately after finishing my degree, I continued to work with protest for a little longer. Now, it seems in the UK that we have beaten the animal rights extremists, and by we, I mean the entire population of the UK has beaten it. And so the next challenge was really over here. I thought it'd be an interesting thing to try and make a similar organization to protest. And I also thought that it appears that people don't have the information ready here in the US. They're just not aware of some of the truths behind animal research because many animal rights organizations are actively trying to misinform the public on the issue.
When you talked about we in the United Kingdom prevailing on this matter, are you talking there about prevailing over what you call extremists, or are you talking about winning an intellectual argument over the right to use animals in research? Because a lot of people who support animal rights are not extremists or violent.
Sure, and I think it's both. Certainly we have beaten back extremism, which has gone right down in the UK, thanks to efforts from the police, the government, and from the people not giving support to extremism anymore. However, we've also won the what you might call the more academic argument. People are starting to realize when polls are taken, it turns out that 80 to 90% of the general population support animal research. And a lot of that is hard support, so it doesn't matter how you ask the question. Whereas here, the percentages you get from the public seem to very much depend on how you ask the question, whether you include medicine as a word in the question, whether you use the word animal research or animal testing, things like that.
Okay. That's Tom Holder, co-founder of Protest, a group in Britain that supports the right of scientists to use animals in research. He now lives in the US and has founded a similar group called Speaking of Research. He spoke earlier today at the UC Davis Primate Center. Tom Holder, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, the local all-girl rock band Aphrodite's Trainwreck plays live in our studio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to Insight live online. To stream our show, go to capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from KXJZ News, California DMV offices will be closed on Saturdays because of the budget standoff. Plus, Sacramento City Council must decide soon whether to give top city officials a 4% pay raise, even as the city deals with budget cuts. Those stories are later today on All Things Considered. School's out for summer, but there's a summer education program in Sacramento that even Alice Cooper would approve of. It's called Stairway to Stardom, and it gives 11 to 18-year-olds the chance to be in a rock band. They learn how to write, play, and record their music, and may earn accreditation or credits in the process. This weekend, Stairway to Stardom wraps up with a free concert. One of the bands joins us. You'll hear them play an original song. But first, here's the director of Stairway to Stardom, Larissa Brisky. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much for having us.
How many people sign up to do this? Are they mainly active musicians?
They are amateur, novice musicians for the most part, young kids just learning to play their instruments. We have about 100 kids in the program this year, all between the ages of 10 and 18.
How many of them are actually playing in bands already?
asked, very small percentage of them are actually already in bands. They come to the program with the express purpose of learning what it's like to be in a band for the first time. So this, for most of them, this is their very first experience in a band.
Wow. And how are the bands actually formed? Do they form themselves, or do you decide who's in which band, or what?
We decide. It's a very difficult process because they audition for the program. They have a very simple audition that they have to pass, and then we basically place them into bands based on their availability, their ability, their competency on their instruments, and then the style of music that they like. So it's kind of a little bit like concentration, putting the bands together.
Now, we have one of the bands in our studio, and there's something unusual. They're a first for Stairway to Stardom. Tell us what that is.
The very first all-female Stairway to Stardom band. And I was talking about this earlier. It happened accidentally. We just were putting the bands together, and we had this band, and we looked at all the Polaroids and all the enrollment forms, and we're like, wow, this is an all-girl band, and we've never had that before. So it's kind of cool.
That's Larissa Brisky, director of the Stairway to Stardom Music Education Program from Skips Music. Before we hear a song, Iris Shanks is the singer. Iris, welcome.
Hi, well, thanks.
How old are you?
I'm 13.
And did you want to be in an all-girl band?
No, actually, I was kind of hoping that it would be kind of like half and half, like half girls, half guys. But I'm right now really glad that it's an all-girl band.
Why? What's so good about it?
Well, it's just we can have like fun and we can talk about things that like co-ed bands can't talk about, and we could just like hang out, and we have like similar opinions on a lot of things, and it just kind of works.
And when you auditioned, did you want to be a singer?
Yeah, I did. I also tried out for bass, but me and Larissa both kind of decided that that wasn't right. So
Sophia Jorgensen is a drummer. Sophia, can you step forward?
Hi.
How old are you?
I'm 11.
And you play drums. Did you play drums before?
Yeah.
So you wanted to be a drummer in this band?
Yeah.
And were you looking to be in an all-girl band?
I was just really hoping I would get in.
She just wanted to get into the program.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Larissa, do many people not get in?
There are a couple of people every year. We just aren't able to find a good fit for them. It's not necessarily because they aren't good enough to be in the program. Maybe they just don't have the availability that they need. They have to rehearse quite a bit.
Yes.
And they have to have a pretty flexible summer schedule. So a couple of people didn't make it in, but most of them do.
Well, we're going to hear a song performed live in our studio by Aphrodite's Trainwreck. First, though, Emma Simpson, the bassist. Emma's
yes.
been on Insight before. Emma, welcome back.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what the song is called and how you all wrote it?
Well, this song is called Clumsy Choreography, and our singer, she wrote and performed it already, and we kind of collaborated on it, and our coach, Thomas Murphy, he helped us a lot on it,
okay.
So it's all collaborative.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to hearing it as Sophia goes behind a partition here so that the drums, the bongos, don't overwhelm the sound in our studio. Our guests are the all-girl band Aphrodite's Trainwreck. They're going to play Clumsy Choreography. Take it away.
Tumblings, but no one really knows who the other dancer is. You take your partner's hand, you begin to sway. Maybe it's tomorrow and maybe it's today, but you know you're gonna dance with him somehow. Catch my breath and I'll straighten up. I can only hope that I'm out of luck. Put on my shoes and I brush my hair, and my only wish is that you would be there. Trying to find a reason why, yeah. Because of you I have to hide. Trying to find a reason why. nobody's perfect. Yeah, nobody's perfect.
Wow, I'm really impressed. That's tremendous. That's
Thanks.
Clumsy Choreography, performed and written by my guests, Aphrodite's Trainwreck. It's a band with five girls in it, aged 11 through 15. So, Iris, you wrote the words. Did you write the words before the camp started, or did you come up with this?
I actually wrote this in around, like, maybe December. But the chorus that we just played, we played it twice through, we actually had to write that in because we decided that the song just wasn't really long enough how it was.
Yes. We don't have enough microphones to go around, so we'll go back to Emma Simpson. Emma, tell us a little bit more about how you came up with the music. Did y'all just jam along with Iris singing?
Well, Iris kind of had a setup of what the chords would go, and then we all added bits and pieces of all our own ideas, and again, our coach helped a lot with that.
Yes.
And, yeah, that was pretty much.
And can anyone tell us where the name of the band came from, Aphrodite's Trainwreck?
Well... Since we're the only all-girl band, we decided it needed to be something to let them know that we're all girls. And, well, Aphrodite
is looking at you.
Oh, well, yeah, you can kind of tell when you see us. But Aphrodite is the Greek goddess of beauty and love. And then for the train wreck part, we were just kind of playing around with what sounded cool. And bam, train wreck, it worked.
Wasn't it because, like... We were, like, messing up, and then we were like, oh, it sounds like a train wreck. And then we're like, oh, Aphrodite's train wreck.
Very good. Aphrodite's train wreck. Larissa Brisky, director of the Stairway to Stardom music education program that Aphrodite's train wreck is part of. How many bands are on the bill at this free concert on August 10th?
22 bands.
22 bands?
22 bands.
And do they all play one song or what?
They each play three songs, actually. They have 8 weeks to each band must write three original songs. So.
And so it's a long concert.
It's a long concert. It's about 5 hours long.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a long day.
Any big industry people going to be there?
There will
Simon
be...
Cowell, maybe?
Oh, let's hope not. actually, we do have a couple of special guests. One of them is Jeff Tamalier, who was the guitar player for Tower Power for some time. He's going to be there, which is kind of exciting. And we have a lot of industry people who represent the music and music retail industry because it is put on by Skips Music. So,
and how much assistance did the tutors or the teachers give the bands in terms of coming up with writing those songs?
They don't write the songs for them at all. They just give them guidance as far as structure and arrangement and things like that, and basically kind of teach them how to be in a band, which is kind of a weird thing to try to teach. But as Emma was explaining, they have a coach. Each band is assigned a coach who's a professional musician who kind of helps them through the process, and they meet with that coach once a week. And the end result is the big concert that you'll see on Sunday.
And is the goal of this to help people be rock stars, or is it something else?
No, because if that were the case, I'd join. No, I mean, ultimately, success is, you know, are you doing something that you enjoy? And these girls are obviously a testament to that. Music is something that's just amazing that
yes,
they really, really enjoy. And it you know, it's a positive thing. And so in Stairway to Stardom, we try to encourage that. We try to encourage them to be musicians for the rest of their lives. So that's the kind of success that we're looking for. Not necessarily rock stardom, although that would be cool. Yes, ladies, to be rock stars?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, who knows? Well, based on that song, who knows? They could be back in InSight when the big stars.
Know. Yeah.
Very good. Well, thanks to you all. Iris Shanks, vocals, Shannon Allen, guitar, Jennifer Connolly, guitar, Emma Simpson, bass, Sophia Jorgensen, drums. They are Aphrodite's Trainwreck. They and a whole lot of other bands are on the bill at the Stairway to Stardom concert on August 10th. It starts at noon at the Holiday Inn off of Madison Avenue in Sacramento. Thanks so much and good luck.
Oh,
thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
And thanks also to Larissa Brisky, who's director of the Stairway to Stardom program. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about all the guests and topics in our show, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers were Ellie Fox and Hawa Amin Arsala. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The assistant producer is Robin Souza. The senior producer, Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. The girls can go running out of the studio in just a second. Thank you for joining us.